The biggest industries today, the multinationals, are not interested so much in efficiency in production or competition at price or product level, but they are competing at the government level. They are competing with each other to capture control of the levers of government so they can then use the power structure of government to eliminate or hinder their competition. Now that is why we have the paradox of the rich socialist. This is one of the things that the new student of the subject can never quite understand, why rich men, the richest men in the nation, as a matter of fact, are apparently socialists and promoting the welfare state and other collectivist schemes. The answer is they need government. Monopoly needs government to enforce its monopoly and to oppose its competition. They are sure that because of their tremendous political influence in that government, that they themselves can escape the negative features of that government control. They are sure that because of their wealth, they can buy enough politicians and bureaucrats so that the rules and regulations that suppress the average man will somehow not apply to them. And generally, they have been right. In other words, they are planning to rule.
Warning. You are about to enter the reality zone, a place where truth is stranger than fiction, where knowledge is king, where myths are shattered and deceptions exposed. It's a place where the lessons of history are found, and where true life adventures reveal the hidden nature of man. If you proceed, you will not be able to return to the twilight zone from which you came. You have 5 seconds remaining to escape.
Welcome to the Reality Zone. I'm Ed Griffin. When I was in school, I was taught that monopoly was a phenomenon of capitalism. It was described as the extreme form of it. Unbridled capitalism was the phrase that was used. Capitalists were portrayed as selfish and mean-spirited people who acquired great wealth at the expense of the common man. Socialists, on the other hand, were portrayed as generous and humanitarian people who cared about their neighbors and who believed in sharing the nation's wealth with everyone. I was given to believe that for the betterment of society, monopolies needed to be prevented, or at least regulated by government. That was the theory behind antitrust laws, restraint of trade laws, and public utility laws. It wasn't until many years later that I entered the reality zone and observed that there was a huge difference between theory and practice. At first, I couldn't understand why some of the wealthiest men in the world are socialists. Why would these people support government regulation over their own businesses? And why would they advocate a progressive income tax? Gradually, the truth began to dawn, and I came to understand that monopoly is not based on free enterprise competition, but the escape from it. It is not the product of capitalism, but the bedfellow of socialism. And that became the topic of the speech you are about to hear. I made this presentation on October 4, 1975, at the Palladium Auditorium in Hollywood, and I called it The Myth and Meaning of Monopoly Capitalism.
Thank you very much, Mr. Armour, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I don't know how much trouble we're in here this morning. I've got 22 index cards. I've never given this talk before, and generally a 22-card talk is pretty long. So, let's hope for the best. My wife and I had the privilege of having Dr. and Mrs. Richardson as our weekend guests, and on the way in to the Palladium here this morning, we drove into the parking lot, you know, where the big sign says monthly parking rates, and Mrs. Richardson in the back seat said, I knew this was going to be a long-winded affair, but monthly parking rates? That's too much. Well, let's hope she's wrong on that. You know, there's an old adage that says, what we don't know cannot hurt us. Well, that's really not true, is it? What we don't know can hurt us, but there's something even worse than not knowing something. I'd like to amend that statement to say, what we do know that simply isn't so can hurt us even more. It's not what we don't know that's the problem. It's what we do know that is false. And I'd like to devote my remarks this morning to just one example of that truth. Now, one of the things that we all know, because we've all heard it over and over again, is this. Monopoly is the end product of free enterprise capitalism. Monopoly is the extreme form of free enterprise capitalism. And monopoly, therefore, is inevitable in a system of free enterprise capitalism. Now that, ladies and gentlemen, is something that we all know that simply is not so. I think it's probably best, just to get off on the same foot, all of us together, to define monopoly. Different dictionaries give different definitions, but the one on my desk says that monopoly is a condition or a situation that exists where it is possible for one person or a group of persons or corporation, an entity, one single entity, to have exclusive rights of production or offering services so that it is possible to charge a higher price than would be possible or than would be fixed by open competition. Now, there's no controversy on that. We all have a pretty good idea of what monopoly is. And I think probably one of the best examples of a monopolist in history can be found by studying the case history of old John D. Rockefeller I. As you undoubtedly know, John D. built the first oil monopoly in the world in the 1870s. And he did that on the philosophy, and this is a direct quote attributed by many of Rockefeller's biographers, a direct quote attributed to him himself. He used to say over and over again, "Competition is a sin." Rockefeller's whole life was devoted to one goal, and that was the elimination of competition, and thus the creation of monopoly. One of the better biographers of John D. Rockefeller was John T. Flynn, and in his book called God's Gold, he explains what I've just said this way. Flynn said, quote, "His entry into business and his career after that would be in a large measure the story of American economic development and the war against laissez-faire." Rockefeller was definitely convinced that the competitive system under which the world had operated was a mistake. It was a crime against order, efficiency, economy. It could be eliminated only by abolishing all rivals. His plan, therefore, took a solid form. He would bring all his rivals in with him. The strong ones he would bring in as partners. The others would come in as stockholders. Those who would not come in would be crushed. End quote. And when you examine the entire life and career of John D. Rockefeller, you soon see that this analysis is 100% accurate in everything that Rockefeller did. And so we must observe in passing that monopoly, the essence of monopoly, is not free enterprise competition, but in fact just the opposite from it. It is the escape from competition that is the essence of monopoly. It's a very fundamental fact that is not, unfortunately, is not taught or not made clear in the high schools and the universities of our land. It was certainly not made clear to me when I went through school, and it wasn't until just a few years ago, really, that the full impact of this truth finally made itself known to me. Okay, enough for monopolies. What about cartels? A cartel is not too much different from a monopoly, except perhaps on a grander scale. A cartel is a grouping, generally it's a grouping of corporate interests who are seeking to escape competition between themselves. Quite often the cartel exists across international boundaries, but it may not necessarily involve more than one nation. As long as we have a grouping of separate corporate interests seeking to eliminate competition between themselves, we're dealing here with a cartel. Now, the way in which they do this is by entering into a series of cartel agreements. The specific objectives of these agreements are to eliminate competition in certain specific areas. For instance, several large corporations or groupings of corporations will come together and agree not to violate certain price structures. Now, that's the most obvious form of a cartel or a monopoly agreement, not to charge a price lower than a certain agreed-upon level. Or they may agree to divide up world markets. They may agree, for instance, to give a certain conglomerate the North American rights to manufacture and distribute, whereas another grouping will have the rights in Asia or Africa, and still a third grouping will have the rights of Europe, and so forth. They may agree to divide among themselves certain products. They may agree, for instance, that this grouping of companies will remain in oil and petroleum products, such as Standard Oil of New Jersey, and Standard Oil's partner, IG Farben, in Germany, would agree, therefore, to have an exclusive right to all things pertaining to chemicals and drugs. And these two giants, IG Farben and Standard Oil of New Jersey, can come together and agree not to step on each other's toes. In fact, they can agree, as they did, that whenever Standard Oil would go into the business of drugs or commercial chemicals, they would do so jointly with IG Farben in jointly owned corporations. And Farben in turn agreed if ever they went into the field of oil or petroleum products, they would do so jointly with Standard Oil. And so by the layering one upon the other of these cartel agreements, gradually the areas of competition between the conglomerates or between the monopolistic structures, those areas of competition are narrowed and narrowed until finally the ultimate end of this process, is that they no longer compete in any way. They are, for all practical purposes, as one. It may be that in this process and in the ultimate stage, they will remain separately owned. They'll have separate corporate stockholders. Officers of the various groups will be separate, but they will move as one because they will be locked together, arm in arm, by so many cartel agreements that nothing they do, insofar as facing the consumer market is concerned, nothing they do is outside of the cartel agreement. And so the end process of that cartel concept, therefore, the ultimate extension, is a one-world corporate entity. It is also important for us to realize, when we're looking at cartels, that the participants of necessity always will abandon their national loyalties. They become true supranationals. I use the word supranationals rather than internationals because international implies an interaction between nations, whereas supranationals, that term implies rising above the concept of national states. And this is exactly what these people consider themselves to be, is above national loyalties. Let's just take an example. The Ford Motor Company and its empire is probably one of the better examples that we could look at as an example of international cartel. It is a matter of historical record that the Ford Motor Company became interlocked with many other corporations around the world through a series of cartel agreements over the past years. Prior to World War II, they became intensely interlocked with IG Farben, which I mentioned a moment ago. And through that interlock, they became tied in with Standard Oil of New Jersey and through DuPont and other corporations elsewhere in the world also. But in a particular example, we're looking at the Ford Motor Company of Germany, and we find that the IG Farben cartel there owned 40% of the stock of Ford Motor Germany. And Karl Bosch and Karl Crouch, who were the two top executives of IG Farben in Germany, sat on the board of directors of the Ford Motor Company in Germany. In return, we find that Edsel Ford in the United States was appointed to the board of directors of the American IG, which was the American holding corporation for the interests of IG Farben in this country. And so that just gives you a quick little glimpse of how the interlocking directorate can take place between large corporations. The significance of that is this: that during World War II, when Nazi Germany and the United States were engaged in deadly war, the German-based Ford Company continued to operate completely independent. This is amazing, because when the war broke out, or when the Nazis consolidated their power in Germany to launch the war, one of the first things they did was to nationalize or confiscate all foreign-owned industry in Germany. All foreign-owned industry was nationalized, and it was incorporated into the Hermann Goering Werk. But the Ford Motor Company was not. It was allowed to continue operating independently. Why? Part of the answer comes to us from the records of the Nuremberg trials. Very interesting documents to read there. If you have some spare time on a rainy Sunday afternoon, go down to your library and get them out, read them. You'll be amazed what you'll learn about international cartels and monopolies. In the testimony at Nuremberg, Karl Crouch, who was the head of IG Farben, testified as follows, quote, "I myself knew Henry Ford and admired him. I went to see Goering personally about that. I told Goering that I myself knew his son Edsel too, and I told Goering that if we took the Ford independence away from them in Germany, it would aggrieve friendly relations with American industry in the future." In the future, notice. See, they're looking beyond the war. "I counted on a lot of success for the adaptation of American methods in German industries, but that could be done only in friendly cooperation." Goering listened to me, and then he said, "I agree. I shall see to it that the Deutsche Fordwerk will not be incorporated in the Hermann Goering Werk." Thus, he said, "we succeeded in keeping the Fordwerk working and operating independently." End quote. Of course, this also happened in Nazi-occupied France. All the while that the war was going on, the Ford Motor Company in France was manufacturing trucks and military hardware for the Nazis, and that too was operating independently. And all during this time, the managers of the Ford Motor in France were carrying on correspondence with or sending reports to Edsel Ford in the United States, telling him what kind of progress was being made, how much profit was being made, and what rosy picture was being painted for the future. For instance, Maurice Dollfuss, who was the chairman of the board of the Ford Motor Company in France, the French subsidiary, sent a letter just before the war broke out to Edsel Ford, and he said this, quote, "The attitude you have taken, together with your father, of a strict neutrality, has been an invaluable asset for the production of your companies in Europe." And that was just before the war broke out. Of course, everybody knew it was going to break out because the German war machine had been in the process of mobilization for many, many months, and all of the plants were producing military hardware. The troops were being amassed for training and moved to the borders. So it came as no great surprise to anyone. And then after the war broke out, we see that it made no difference either, because 2 months after Pearl Harbor, and after an official declaration of war between the United States and Nazi Germany, Dollfuss reported to Edsel Ford the 1941 net profits of the operation at 58 million francs. And then in his letter he said, quote, "Since the state of war between the USA and Germany, I am not able to correspond with you very easily. I have asked Lesto to go to Vichy and mail this. We are continuing our production as before. The financial results for the year are very satisfactory. We have formed our African company." And then he goes on to give further details of the business. And so I repeat something we have to keep in mind, that it is absolutely impossible for those engaged in international cartels, or these multinational corporations as we now call them, it is impossible for those men to remain loyal to the nation of their birth. If we need any further example of that, just read the public pronouncements of the executives of these multinational companies. Since we're talking about Ford, we notice that in the December 19, 1970 issue of Business Week magazine, Robert Stevenson, who was vice president of the Ford Motor Company, said this, "We don't consider ourselves basically an American company." Come as a surprise to you? Because we don't consider ourselves basically an American company. We are a multinational company. And when we approach a government that doesn't like the United States, we always say, well, whom do you like? Britain? Germany? We carry a lot of flags. Along that same line, and perhaps even more to the point, we noticed that a top executive of the Mobil Oil Company in the fall of 1973 was on television, and this is what he said. He said, "I've never been faced with a situation where I'd say to myself, I'm only going to be a good citizen of one country. Because if I do that, I'm no longer a multinational oil company." End quote. Which is certainly true. Another very instructive example of international cartels and all they represent and all they do is AT&T. We notice from the record that, like the Ford Motor Company, AT&T also invested heavily in pre-war Nazi Germany. Tremendous amounts of investment capital went to Germany and went directly into the corporate structures that were at that time busily engaged in preparations for war. In 1938, for instance, one of AT&T's subsidiaries in Germany acquired the ownership of 28% of the Focke-Wulf manufacturing facilities, the Focke-Wulf Corporation. As you may recall, this is the famous name that was attached to the German fighter planes, the Focke-Wulf fighter planes.
This recording continues on side two.
This company was then in the production of these fighter planes, and AT&T acquired ownership of 28% ownership of the entire company. Other plants of AT&T in Germany, all during the war, were busily producing communications equipment for the Nazi high command. Meanwhile, back in the United States, AT&T was fiercely patriotic in defense of the American cause. In fact, the head of AT&T, who was Colonel Benn, received the Medal of Merit for all that he and his company had done, specifically in the invention and production of something called the Huff-Duff. The Huff-Duff, which was a new kind of sonar radar, which was able to detect Nazi submarines. And then finally, ladies and gentlemen, in 1967, this was 30 years after the fact of the war, 1967, AT&T received from the federal government, or I should say, received from you and me in the form of tax dollars taken from us in taxes, $27 million for damages inflicted on their Focke-Wulf plants in Germany during the war. The excuse for that was that this allegedly was American property damaged during the war. Well, okay, you see, it pays to have friends in Washington. These were the plants that were producing the German fighter planes. Anthony Sampson wrote a book called The Sovereign State of AT&T. And in that book, he had this very profound statement. He said, "Thus, while AT&T Focke-Wulf planes were bombing Allied ships, and AT&T lines were passing information to German submarines, AT&T direction finders were saving other ships from their torpedoes. If the Nazis had won, AT&T in Germany would have appeared impeccably Nazi. As they lost, it reemerged as impeccably American." End quote. Let's turn our attention now to the question of the relationship between monopoly and government. It is a fact that monopoly cannot exist without government intervention. If monopoly does not have access to the levers of power of government to eliminate its competitors, then its competitors will compete, and it will no longer be a monopoly. We find that in history, all of the monopolies have had to rely on government to protect their monopolies. The robber barons of the past in this country are certainly a good example. If you recall the great dynasties that were carved out from the mountains and the prairies to build the transcontinental railroads across the United States, these dynasties were acquired through political influence, which literally gave millions upon millions of acres of land to the corporations over which to build their railroads. If they had to go out and buy that land or acquire it in some other way, they couldn't have done it. Certainly we know that the robber barons of the present cannot exist without the intervention of their political puppets. We have many examples of that. The so-called fair trade laws. It sounds very good. Fair trade laws. We certainly need fair trade, don't we? This is a law passed in the name of the people. And yet when you realize what a fair trade law is, it's a law which prevents the shopkeeper from cutting his prices to you, from lowering his prices. He is prohibited by law from offering you a product at a price lower than the one stamped on the box. Now that is a perfect example of the use of government to protect the profit structure of a monopolistic industry. Another example are the new drug laws. A company today, in order to get a new drug on the market, has to go through tons and tons of paperwork and red tape. Now, that's all in the name of protecting the people, of course. After all, you don't want these new drugs coming on the market that are not thoroughly analyzed and checked and researched, do you? The end result of it is that the small drug company cannot afford to do that kind of paperwork, and so they are gradually being squeezed out by the large multinational drug companies that easily can afford the $1 million or $2 to get the paperwork done, and so the large companies are using this law to squeeze out their small company competitors. The Federal Aeronautics and Aviation Board is another example. All the rules and regulations they have of preserving the routes among airlines. No small airline in the United States is able to get in there and try and compete because you need permission to fly from here to there. And you can't get permission. That's all nicely worked out between the major airlines so that there's no competition between them. And there's no competition on price either. That's all carefully worked out by the FAA. Those laws are there to prevent competition, ladies and gentlemen, not to protect you. What you pay for moving your furniture from one city to the next is fixed by law. There's no competition between moving companies on price. It's not allowed. Railway shipping charges are not allowed to be lowered below what the companies think they can charge. You cannot compete. Even the delivery of milk to your door, the price of that milk is fixed at a level below which the supplier is not permitted to sell. It's all fixed by law. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this could go on and on. The economy of the United States, and surely of the world, in my opinion, is somewhere between 80 and 95% cartelized. We speak of a free enterprise system. You're dreaming. We have a certain semblance of it left. We have the outward appearances of it. The small entrepreneur is still in there plugging away, but he is being squeezed out by taxes, which the large businesses don't have to pay. The large cartelists, such as Rockefeller, have the tax-exempt foundations to preserve their great fortunes. They don't pay these taxes, but the little guy in there who's trying to compete is gradually being destroyed by laws which have been passed by the monopolists and the cartels to eliminate competition. The January 1973 issue of the Monthly Review of the Bank of Hawaii, which is a pretty savvy bank. If you read their newsletters and their monthly reviews, they really know what's going on. It's a wonder they haven't been squeezed out, but they're still in there plugging away. The January 1973 Monthly Review of the Bank of Hawaii had this analysis. Quote, "There appears to be no ready answer to the complex, interrelated domestic and international developments. Those standing to lose the most include the individuals who seek to establish their own businesses and those independent domestic firms seeking to compete in the traditional open marketplace. They face increasing regimentation through bureaucratic red tape and preempted markets by federally subsidized competition. Virtually immune are the multinational corporations whose massive investments abroad and effective lobbying positions and allegiance to a world market, unobstructed by local government and competition, place them in a position to not only straddle these developments, but to encourage them. End quote. Several years ago, a book was published by Ferdinand Lundberg called The Rich and the Super Rich. There's a lot in that book that makes me quite angry. I think it's a little too many of the old leftist cliches about exploitation of the working class and so forth. But there's a lot in that book to benefit from, a lot of knowledge and a lot of truth. Lundberg put aside his cliches long enough at one point to make, I think, a profound observation. He said, "The restriction of free enterprise has also come principally from businessmen who have constantly sought to increase government regulation in their own interest, as in the case of tariffs, subsidies, and prohibition of price cutting on trademarked items. In fact, the interests of businessmen have changed to a considerable extent from efficiency in production to efficiency in public manipulation, including manipulation of the government for attainment of preferential advantages." End quote. Now that, ladies and gentlemen, in a nutshell, is what the ball game is all about. The biggest industries today, the multinationals, are not interested so much in efficiency in production or competition at price or product level, but they are competing at the government level. They are competing with each other to capture control of the levers of government so they can then use the power structure of government to eliminate or hinder their competition. Now that is why we have the paradox of the rich socialist. This is one of the things that the new student of the subject can never quite understand, why rich men, the richest men in the nation as a matter of fact, are apparently socialists and promoting the welfare state and other collectivist schemes. The answer is they need government. Monopoly needs government to enforce its monopoly and to oppose its competition. And they need a socialist government. They need a collectivist government. They are sure that because of their tremendous political influence in that government, that they themselves can escape the negative features of that government control. They are sure that because of their wealth, they can buy enough politicians and bureaucrats so that the rules and regulations that suppress the average man will somehow not apply to them. And generally, they have been right. In other words, they are planning to rule. And they are planning to rule you and me. Let's turn now to the question of world government. It is another fact that the United Nations was created and sustained by two apparently opposed groups. The super-rich industrialists, principally centered around that organization called the Council on Foreign Relations, and another group centered around the International Communist Party. Now, back in 1964, when I published my first book called The Fearful Master, A Second Look at the United Nations, the level of my awareness of what was going on in the world was, frankly, quite limited. At that time, about all I could see was the menace of international communism. And in the book, I concentrated almost entirely on the extent to which identified communists, primarily those working on the federal payroll at the time, although they were not identified at the time, later they were identified. They were secret communists working primarily in the State Department and the Treasury Department. These men and women were responsible primarily for the work done in creating the United Nations. If I were to rewrite that book today, I don't think I would change a single part of it except that part. Everything else stands just as accurately today as it was in 1964. But upon further research, further awakening to the facts of life around me, I discovered that there were a lot of people involved other than communists, but people who shared exactly the same objectives and goals as those of the Communist Party, but people who were certainly not communists, they were very wealthy, wealthy men. And then I had to go through this awakening and this question asking and answering to find out why and how could people like this become involved with communists. The truth of the matter is that I believe when you go through the list, you will find that there are 74, and there may be more, but I have been able to find 74 prominent people in the creation of the United Nations in this country who were members of the CFR. 74. Now, many of those were also communists. They were members of the CFR and members of the Communist Party, but most of them were merely members of the CFR, as far as we know. Now, why should members of the CFR, which represents the international monopoly in this country, the CFR primarily is a grouping of very wealthy industrialists from the highest multinational corporations, why should they become involved in the UN? And the reason, I may be sounding a little redundant here because I'm repeating myself, is that monopolists and cartels need world government in order to elevate their monopoly to the world level. They are sure that they can and do control this world government. The fact that the cartel has fostered the United Nations and continues to support it in every way possible is obvious to even the most casual observer. We note, for instance, that the very land on which the United Nations stands was donated by Rockefeller. We note, for instance, that the Chase Manhattan Bank, which is a Rockefeller bank, is the United Nations official banker. We notice, for instance, that the president of the UN World Bank for many years was John J. McCloy, who was chairman of the board of directors of the Chase Manhattan Bank. We notice, for instance, that David Rockefeller is chairman of the CFR, which is the organization that supplies so much of the encouragement and staffing of the United Nations and the State Department, which also has supported the United Nations for so many years. There's an interesting person by the name of Charles Levinson, who is secretary of the International Federation of Chemical and General Workers Union in Geneva, Switzerland. Now, he's had a long life of battling the multinational cartels. He knows what they're all about from firsthand experience. He has been a negotiator with many of their leaders. In the June 17, 1974 issue of the Wall Street Journal, there was an article based on an interview with Charles Levinson. And this is what that article said. Instead of seeking truth, Mr. Levinson says the UN officials want clowns to perform in a forum carefully contrived to make the UN look alive while giving the multinationals a protective coat of whitewash. In Mr. Levinson's view, the UN and such prestigious private groups as the Washington-based Atlantic Council and the Rockefeller Foundation are all part of an international elite that manages much of the world's business, finance, politics, and even wars to its own advantage. To a large extent, he says, the power is centered within David Rockefeller's operation. End quote. Please note, ladies and gentlemen, that he is a socialist. I'll have a few comments on that in closing, but I'm going to give you an advance peek at some interesting things that are happening around the world. People are coming together from large diverse points of view, many diverse points of view. They're coming together, closer together, and that is a healthy sign. Yes, it's true that the American people know a lot of things that simply are not true. For instance, we know that there is a deep and impassable gulf that exists between the anti-establishment radicals and the moss-backed conservative constitutionalists. No way can these people ever come together. And that is not so. The anti-establishment radicals are right when they condemn monopoly capitalism. They're absolutely 100% correct. And many of the conservatives have not been able to recognize that truth when they heard it. But these anti-establishment radicals must also realize that the monopoly capitalists whom they condemn are not the torchbearers of the traditional American way of life. They do not represent free enterprise capitalism. They must realize that these monopoly capitalists are, in fact, the very leaders of the ideology which the anti-establishment radicals are promoting, that of socialism, collectivism. And so, therefore, they must realize that they have been tricked into doing the very work of the people whom they despise. On the other hand, the moss-backed, reactionary, conservative constitutionalists are right when they condemn and point with alarm to subversion in our government and the growth of that government itself and the resulting loss of individual liberty. But they must stop falling for the same old shell game, too, and being tricked into promoting the objectives of the very people they despise. They have simply got to stop running to the polls every 2 years and every 4 years and electing members of the CFR or others involved in large cartel industry or the foundations who are part of the very establishment which they are opposing. And so, in truth, what I'm trying to say here to you this morning, ladies and gentlemen, is that there are practically no real differences between any group in the vast majority of the American people, regardless of all of the superficial things that divide us, regardless of the length of our hair, our sex, our race, our age, our religion, our education, our lifestyles, regardless of all of those things, we are all Americans. And the time to close ranks against our common enemy is now. Thank you.
This program is from the audio archives of the Reality Zone. If you are a subscriber to the audio archives, you are entitled to make as many duplicate copies as you wish to share with your friends. There is no additional charge for this, so long as you are a subscriber and the copies are given, not sold. If you would like to become a subscriber, ask for our free introductory tape, which provides the details. Zone dwellers receive free cassettes each month and an attractive binder suitable for bookshelves. For more information, visit our website at www.realityzone.com or call our toll-free number, 800-595-6596. That number again is 800-595-6596. The Reality Zone is a subsidiary of American Media.